Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Top of the Morning on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. Equities recovered from mid-October wobbles to finish last week at an all-time high. The focus this week is on the likely meeting between Presidents Trump and Xi at the APEC summit, earnings from Mag 7 companies, and the Fed's rate cut decision at the FOMC meeting on Wednesday. So joining us to discuss this all, glad to welcome back Jason Draho, Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas with the UBS Chief Investment Office. Jason, good morning. Thank you for dropping by on this Monday to begin the week. We do have a very busy few days ahead of us, so thank you for joining us to provide a preview and set the table, so to speak.
Good morning, Dan. Happy Monday. Yeah, it's a busy week as we come to the end of October.
So, Jason, have to begin with the markets. What have investors been focused on that has contributed to pushing them to an all-time high?
Well, I think there's three kind of main things. One is if we think go back to the middle of the month when there was these volatility and pullback in equity markets globally, the starting point for that was escalating tensions between the U.S. and China on trade matters, including the threat of additional tariffs. That has since sort of been dialed back, and as of over the weekend, there's reports of a framework of a deal between the U.S. and China. So I think one is a de-escalation to some extent of the rhetoric that existed. It looks like we're more kind of moving towards some sort of at least truce for the time being among U.S. and China and other countries as well potentially. So that was one factor. Another is the earnings season. It's still relatively early in the reporting of Q3 earnings. We have about 25% of the S&P 500 market cap. Another roughly 45% will report this week. But of those who have reported, the results have been quite solid. So we're getting roughly 80% of companies are beating on revenue. Another 80% are beating on their earnings expectations. And the combination of beating on both is about two-thirds. These are above the long-term averages, and by a decent amount. So it's a good earnings season so far overall. The median beat for earnings is about 5%. Normally it's kind of around 3.5%. So the results are coming in ahead of expectations and going into the earnings season. There wasn't the sort of a downgrade of the earnings outlook that typically takes place throughout the quarter, where earnings expectations from analysts go down about 3 percentage points and then companies beat by 3.5. So you're kind of back where you started. In this case, there wasn't a downward revision by and large, for the market overall, and now the numbers are beating. So, our expectation, CIO, is that we get about 10% earnings growth, and we're on track right now to beat that. So, if you extrapolate those trends, I think this is going to be reflective of other companies reporting this week. Then you just sort of take up your earnings outlook, and that sort of level shifts everything higher for what you're willing to pay for equities in terms of market levels. The final thing, it's more kind of the investor positioning. There's a lot of talk about obviously investors getting maybe over the skis. Sentiment got just earlier in the month or at the end of September, elevated to some extent. At least those feeling questions about bubbles and things of that sort, investor euphoria. I think that always overstated exactly how investors felt and how they were positioned. I think positioning was elevated but not extreme. There was a few pockets here and there. But once we got those kind of market wobbles early in the month, I think very quickly some of the positioning among systematic investors in particular was cleaned up fairly quickly. Once that happened, you get positioning back to neutral levels roughly. When you get better news, it's a situation where investors can put more kind of capital to work. And so the lack of any trade tensions or de-escalation on that front, we haven't had much economic data, but in some sense, without economic data, then the view doesn't really change, which is relatively constructive on the economy. Earnings has been good as a proxy for the economy. All that would sort of encourage investors to kind of put more capital to work. So I think those combination of factors are what drove the markets higher last week. And looking right now on Monday morning, the same story continues this week.
Now, it is widely expected, Jason, that the Fed will cut rates by 25 basis points at this week's meeting. Do you expect that? And what else are you watching for from this particular meeting?
Well, we do expect the Fed to cut 25 basis points this week, as well as 25 in December and once more in Q1. Jay Powell gave a speech, the Fed chair, almost 2 weeks ago. This is before the Fed went into their blackout period where they don't comment, starting about 10 days before the FOMC meeting. And during that speech, he basically indicated that while growth data looks like it's going to be better or tracking of growth has kind of improved, the evidence that there's further labor market weakness, that continues. So that was in some way a signal that nothing has changed over the past month, even though there isn't some data to suggest that labor market weakness would sort of, you know, warrant another cut. And the inflation data that came out last week, kind of in line with expectations, showing that there's no real surge yet of inflation, you know, due to tariffs. You know, a little bit of a pickup, but not a massive surge. It certainly gives the Fed justification for cutting, you know, next or this week. We still think it's likely for December, but I think, you know, the things that I would watch for are, you know, questions or commentary from Powell during his press conference. He's likely to communicate that, you know, Fed rate cuts are data dependent. And given they don't have a lot of data, it's hard for them to give any real guidance for December. So he would sort of demur on that. He would probably point to the economic projections laid out in September, as well as the dot plot that indicated there'd be three cuts in total this year. And given the one in September, that implied two more this year. That was the median dot, so it wasn't, you know, everyone agreed to that view, but kind of use that as like, we don't have enough new information to kind of change that view. So I think at this point in time, that's a reasonable expectation of how the committee members are thinking. But we are data dependent and things could change, you know, as the data comes in, presuming the government shutdown ends well before the December meeting. So it'll be a little bit of perhaps underwhelming, you know, the multiple cuts, perhaps indicate, you know, nothing has changed in their thinking, but they just don't have enough information to really alter their views, which is kind of where the market is overall. So long and short of it is that, you know, we'll probably be somewhat of an uneventful Fed 25 basis point cut just because we just, you know, don't have enough reasons to change, you know, the view otherwise.
So, Jason, I do want to turn focus to your most recent blog, that titled The Two Most Important Numbers in Economics. Within, you suggest what these two numbers are. So, in your view, what are they?
Well, I think there's some numbers that, you know, Dan, may have come to your mind when I suggest the two most important numbers in economics. Maybe it's the unemployment rate. Maybe it's the inflation rate. Given that they summarize sort of the economy, they influence the Fed policy. It could also be something like the Fed funds rates or the 10-year treasury. Like, these are numbers I think would typically be thought of as like some of the, you know, the most important numbers in economics. I think lurking in the background are two other numbers that I think are relevant when we think about the outlook for the next 1 to 2 years. And they are the neutral Fed funds rate and nominal GDP growth, which I think most investors think, yeah, these are, you know, relevant numbers, but maybe not the most important. So, you know, why is that? And I think we, you know, kind of start off with defining or just making sure we're clear on what these terms are and entail. Starting with the neutral Fed funds rate, you know, I think it's generally accepted that there is a level of the Fed funds rate that is kind of neither restrictive in terms of policy, trying to slow things down to bring down inflation, nor is it, you know, kind of accommodative, meaning the policy is meant to be loose and stimulative to encourage the economy to grow. There's some level where it's kind of roughly balanced. And from a long-term perspective, this is deemed kind of, you know, the neutral rate of the Fed funds rate. Now, the practical challenge with this number is that it's not just uncertain, it's actually unobservable, and it's a theoretical number that really kind of requires, you know, assumptions that you have to make to actually just even begin to estimate, which one would think that alone would sort of rule it out as the most important number, but I think this is, you know, just kind of telling you exactly what it is. It's also why, you know, some of Fed officials, including, you know, Chair Powell, is often, you know, sort of downplaying its importance in sort of for setting monetary policy. So that's one of the numbers I'd say is the most important. The other is nominal GDP growth. You know, nominal GDP is just simplest terms, kind of real GDP, which we often talk about, the economy growing at 2%, 3%, 1% plus inflation. And so if real GDP grows 2% and inflation is out to the long-term Fed target of 2%, nominal GDP grows roughly 2%. There's a little more mechanics in terms of how the nominal GDP is calculated, but as our first approximation, that's, you know, that's what it is. So I think it's those two numbers, the neutral Fed funds rate and nominal GDP, that I think are in some way the most important numbers for the investment outlook over the next year.
With that context, Jason, what makes these two so important?
Well, start with nominal GDP. In some way, it's kind of simple and intuitive that we know we have a federal debt and deficit that are problems. The trajectory of the federal debt, you know, has it going up significantly, especially over the long term. And we have deficits that are forecast to be over 6% basically for the next decade. The only way you can sort of deal with debt and deficits long-term at that level is you basically, or one of the ways you deal with it is you have to have higher growth to mitigate those debt sustainability risks. Now, ideally, the real growth, you know, is higher, so you have a strong economy. And that's the ideal solution, you know, but debt is a nominal asset, you know, so it doesn't change in value. And so if you use nominal GDP, a higher nominal GDP, you kind of constrain this debt problem to some extent. So I think there's that kind of aspect to what makes nominal GDP kind of attractive. And whether you're, President Trump, his administration, or other politicians, I think they all want a situation where, like, well, we want to try and grow our way out of this debt issue, these debt concerns. And that could ultimately mean both higher real growth, but also sort of sticky inflation. So you let the economy kind of run hot. So, and one way to do that, and one way to measure that is like, well, what is nominal GDP growth? And, in the second quarter of this year, nominal GDP grew over 6%. The last few years, it was at 5%, 6%, 9%, going back to, to 21, up through 2024. So it has been an elevated number. That's something to me is kind of important because politicians and policymakers want a higher nominal GDP. The relevance for the neutral Fed funds rate may be a little more tricky to understand, but I think it's also never been higher. And this goes back into the conversation we just had regarding the Fed cutting rates. It's very likely they cut this week, still quite likely they cut in December. But if you look at market pricing for next year, it's the path for the Fed funds rate in 2026 is very wide, meaning the market expects a few more cuts, but, there's also a wide distribution. Maybe they don't cut at all, and others that they might end up cutting four, five, or six times. Even the Fed committee members and their dot plot in September had a wide range of views, with some thinking basically the Fed is going to cut once more and be done, so the Fed funds rate is close to 4%. Others think the Fed is going to cut rates all the way to 2.5%. That's a really wide range of outcomes, and it just speaks a lot of kind of the uncertainty. What you think about how much the Fed will cut, though, is going to depend on what your view is the neutral Fed funds rate. And I think this is where things kind of get interesting, because on that, the Fed committee members are even more dispersed in terms of like a really kind of flat, uniform distribution of like of where they think this neutral Fed funds rate would be, anywhere from 2.5% all the way up to 4%. What's instructive is to look at what Stephen Miron, who was appointed by President Trump back in September to join the committee, he joined right before the September meeting. He dissented at that point in time, suggesting we should cut 50 basis points in September and 150 basis points in total this year. His dot for the long-term Fed funds rate is 2.5%. He's made an argument that ultimately, he thinks the neutral rate is low. It's much lower than everyone else thinks, by and large, and that it did rise over the past years, but it rose because of immigration surge lifted overall kind of growth potential for the U.S. Now net immigration is going to fall significantly. He also thinks that through the fiscal policy measures of President Trump, that the deficits will be a little bit lower. That all sequel means less demand for funding, for capital. That should keep the neutral rate a little bit lower. Now, whether you believe these kind of economic arguments or not, in some way matters less than whether will this become the prevailing thinking among the Fed next year. Just this morning, it's confirmed that there's five finalists to be the President Trump's nominee to be the next Fed chair. That should happen before year end. We should get that announcement. If we have a Fed chair nominee who ascribes to Myron's kind of view that the neutral rate is actually lower, therefore we need to be cutting rates more aggressively, then you have a situation where you have that leading to accommodative policy. And ultimately, if you think your objective as a from a political perspective is higher nominal GDP growth, then it's reasonable to expect you're going to get policies that will have a pro-nominal growth bias. And that includes nominating a Fed chair and other Fed governors who are sympathetic to this kind of Myron's view on the neutral Fed funds rate. So to me, the ultimate kind of comes down to is that why these two numbers are so important is that they can really be an indication of like where is policy going to be next year. And my kind of conjecture is that policy is going to be accommodative for nominal growth overall.
Okay, so Jason, what would you say are the investment implications of these numbers, contingent on your view being correct, of course?
Well, as investors, we're all inundated with economic data, even with the government shutdown, market data, and we try and pour through this to get a better understanding of the state of the economy, and that's critical. But I'd sort of say, like, for the investment outlook over the next year, it actually might hinge more on this unobservable neutral Fed funds rate and sort of where the government and the administration wants nominal GDP growth. And if you kind of have that belief that ultimately they want higher nominal growth and you achieve that by having a lower, essentially neutral Fed funds rate to justify Fed rate cuts, I think that's an important way to think about things. Now, there's no guarantee that's the right way to think about policy in next year, but I think it's also kind of risky to kind of lean against that when you factor everything in. And ultimately, if enough investors sort of believe this, I think what you see is asset prices kind of go higher. A debasement trade that's been sort of prevalent in the markets this month, can continue. Reflation can kind of continue. I talk bubbles, I think, will only grow. What does that mean for investing? Well, I think, 2 weeks ago, we upgraded equities, overall. too attractive. And it's probably predicated on, you know, higher revisions for or expectations for growth for next year, economic growth, GDP growth, and also earnings growth. And if you have higher nominal GDP growth, that sort of, you know, kind of reinforces that view. If this macro environment kind of plays out, then you could also see is, yield curve steepen. So the front end rates go lower as the Fed gets more aggressively. But in an environment where nominal growth is going to be higher, back end rates can also kind of back up. So it's why, given this possibility, we'd prefer to be kind of shorter in terms of maturity going up to 3 to 5 years on the curve, because the 10-year could easily kind of back up. And then the idea is, if this is an environment you're sort of dealing with kind of higher in kind of nominal growth, higher inflation, all is equal to some extent, gold and other sort of stores of value become, you know, more attractive. That's why we maintain gold as an attractive asset class, because it could be a diversifier of this, you know, this whole scenario certainly kind of, you know, plays out. So I think some of our existing asset class views, you know, one of the factors certainly in my mind that sort of supports them is, you know, this kind of this policy environment, and that sort of is predicated on what we think the Fed might do and what we think the federal government might do in terms of ultimately having to have, you know, higher nominal growth.
Well, Jason, very thought-provoking and helpful conversation as we begin what will be a very busy week for the markets, investors. Thank you for dropping by Top of the Morning, Jason.
You're welcome. Have a great week.
Again, today we have been joined by Jason Draho, Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas with the UBS Chief Investment Office. Before we close out, I again want to mention Jason Draho's blog, which we have been making reference to on today's episode. It's available for you now up on UBS.com/CIO. Though for clients of UBS, simply reach out to your UBS financial advisor if you would like to receive a copy of Jason's blog directly. From UBS Studios, I'm Dan Cassidy. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.